Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN Audio, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
The word hero is often overworked, but I want to introduce you to someone truly deserving of that title. His name is Lotfullah Najafzada, and for nearly 10 years, he ran Tolo News, a 24-hour news network in Afghanistan, bravely and honestly telling that country's stories. He lost 11 colleagues during that time and lived himself under constant threat. Now a refugee from Taliban rule, he is a fellow at the University of Chicago's Institute of Politics. And listening to Lotfullah talk about the sacrifices he and his colleagues made for democracy makes you think about just how precious it is. Here's that conversation. Lotfullah, it's great to see you again. How are you doing?
Thank you, David. And it's great to be with you.
Yeah. How are you doing? You're in Canada now?
Right. This is where my parents are. Uh-huh. I've been visiting them, and hopefully I'll be back to Chicago and at the IOP very soon.
I want to talk more about that later, about sort of this post Taliban takeover period and just the itinerant nature of your life during this period. But I really want to go back to the beginning of your story because it's quite extraordinary. It may not seem that way to you because you lived it, but you were born in 1987. This was at the very end of the Russian occupation of Afghanistan.
Right.
They left, and what ensued was essentially civil war. Talk about those early years of your life, because you and your family moved around quite a bit in Afghanistan.
Right. Yeah, they left, I think, 89. So I don't remember that. But the Soviet Union and the invasion, I think, changed the country. Their departure also resulted into a civil war. David, when I remember I was, I think, five when we were getting rockets, RPGs, coming to our yard, to our house, and one or two a day. I think after, you know, a few days, my parents said, well, we can't live here anymore. And we didn't know where to go. So we have been on the run.
Where were you? Were you in Kabul at the time?
We were in Kabul, yeah. We were in the western part of Kabul, known for being brutally damaged and destroyed. If you look at pictures of, you know, Kabul during civil war, particularly the western parts of the city, you don't see any standing building. And that's when we started moving. And I have been on the run since then.
Yeah. I saw somewhere you describing in 1997, you were living with your uncle, and you described the experience of going outside and seeing bodies everywhere. I'm just wondering, What does that do to a 10-year-old kid? What does it do to a 5-year-old to have rockets, landing all around you?
I think they leave you with life-lasting memories and flashbacks and some bitter, memories of your life. I must say, I can never forget the difficulty that my parents were going in just sending us to school. They had to pay, while both of them were unemployed, they had to pay for the public school because the government, there was no government back then. The Civil War and the Taliban's takeover of Mazar-e-Sharif, the incident that you're referring to, this is up in the north of Afghanistan. I think we were hiding for 3 days when the Taliban tried to take over Mazar in 96. After 3 days, we were going to school, and then I think in that particular battle, the Uzbek anti-Taliban commander, General Massoud, or Marshal Massoud now, Dostum, Marshal Dostum, he probably killed around 1,000 Taliban fighters. So we were seeing, you know, these fighters, Taliban dead bodies, as we were going to school. I think, you know, I can never forget that. It tells us and me so much about the tragedy of Afghan life.
Yeah, I mean, this is you as you're 30, what are you, 34 now?
34, yeah.
34-year-old self. I'm just trying to, the reason I ask you, I'm so interested and horrified by this is my dad was a refugee from Eastern Europe, and he grew up during the pogroms there against the Jews, and they fled when their home was blown up. Someone threw a Molotov cocktail through their home, the window of their home, and he didn't talk much about this at all. He didn't want to talk about it, but he did say to me once that he remembered going out with his father to get bread and having to step over bodies to do that. And, I always wondered, you know, where in what place he kept all these memories, because they must have been scarring to him. And
I'm sure. It's difficult to talk about it. It's difficult to, you can't wake up every day and then sort of remember, you know, the terrible things happened to you and people that you cared and loved. Your country and your people in general.
Yeah, especially for a child. You know, how do you even process that as a child? You know, children are supposed to be playing and imagining and not burdened with the specter of violence and dead bodies. Honestly, we have children a few miles from here in Chicago who are living something of the same reality. You know, there's a lot of violence on the streets, a lot of death. And I just wonder if, you know, we're creating a generation of children there, as was the case in Afghanistan, with like post-traumatic stress syndrome.
Right.
From everything that's...
I think for a lot of, it's not just me in Afghanistan. It's, it's not just children of my neighborhood. I think this applies to one, two, or three generations of people in the country who have missed their childhood totally. We didn't have a television set, at our home until I think I was, I don't know, 15 or something. We didn't have, I've never been to a park, not that I remember, before 10 or 12. So I think, this particular part of our life, as people call it, childhood, now that, you know, I have a three-year-old and two-year-old.
Yes.
I can't compare. We're refugees again, but you can't compare it to what we went through, and what so many Afghan children are still going through.
Yes, well, I want to get to that because that there are horrors associated with that we need to shine a light on. But How did your parents explain all of this to you, or was it just a fact of life?
I think it's destiny. It's something that happened to so many people. I think they were just lucky and happy that we were alive.
Yeah. And why were they so determined that you go to school? What was their hope? What was their dream for you?
I think education was something very, very serious in our larger family, not just my parents, my uncles, and I think my grandfather, who was this semi-religious scholar, who gave up on sending his sons to madrasa, but instead sending them to modern school. That was already a revolution, I think, in the village that he was living in. I think that set a precedence to our people in the family, in our family, to go to school. We were living in Ghazni during the civil war in the 90s, early 90s, and I was very young, and I wanted to go to Iran to just, I don't know, become a child laborer or something. And then my father and my mom said, we will never allow you to follow the pattern or the path of probably thousands of other teenagers who were going from that village to Iran to work, because that was this Shia village. Mm-hmm. And I come from Shia parents, so Iran was this traditional destination. Mm-hmm. That they wanted to go, but also others, were going to Pakistan, others were going to the Gulf countries. So I think that was one instruction and decision from my parents that I never forget. They said, this is not the path that we want you to choose, and this was happening at some of the most difficult time, of my life.
They wanted you to stay.
They wanted me to stay with them, but at the same time go to school. And mm-hmm. I know that it was pretty hard for them to even afford the very basic needs of us, going to school.
You became you focused on journalism quite young. Why did you? How did you come to that conclusion? And what was the state of journalism in Afghanistan at that time in your life? I think you were 17 when you started working for a newspaper.
Right. I think when the U.S. invaded Afghanistan, or after the Taliban regime was toppled in 2001, we felt, David, that the country was liberated. There was this the vibe of freedom in the air. And with that freedom, then you have this energy in you that you want to do things. And I think part of that in our bigger family was that, we should, we were still quite young. I mean, cousins and others, we want to get involved politically. Particularly coming from a minority, that was an extra sort of sense of freedom in our family, that we should be more involved. So a cousin or two were already in the media business, doing some journalism, and that somehow encouraged us to do more. In Upper Mazar, even my family started a small family newspaper, which we took a lot of pride for it. That cousin of mine, who is also now in Canada, he was giving us this opportunity. So we become, all of us, I think at some point we're about 12 or 15 journalists in the family. We all became this accidental journalists. Some of us stayed in the business, and the more genius ones, moved on. They tried other things.
your first job was not as a writer, but as a or reporter, but as a designer, of the newspaper. How did you make the transition from designing this small paper to becoming a reporter and a writer?
I think this friend of mine who had this small newspaper in Mazar asked me to come and help with designing because he had nobody else. And then in his family home, he had this one of these old computers. He did not even have a desk, so that computer was on the floor, and I was spending hours, every day designing pages of that A4 newspaper prints. So that's how I started, and then I started going to conferences and others, and then I moved on to a more serious journalism work with NATO. So NATO owned the largest newspaper in the country. It was a biweekly, colorful magazine type, and they had journalists throughout the country because I was interested. So they posted me in Polikhumri. It's another town in northern Afghanistan, and I think I was just 18 very young. That was first time I was on my own in a place where I knew no one. So that's where my real journalistic career began.
Ultimately, a group called Mobi, a big media group formed in Afghanistan. They were starting a 24-hour news network, Tolo News. You became the director of this network at the age of 24. How did that happen?
So Mobi Group is, or has been this amazing media group in the country. I was traveling. I was attending an online journalism training in Germany with a journalist from back then, Tolo TV. Tolo News didn't exist in 2008, I think. And then on the way back to Kabul, he asked me that if he wanted me to, he asked me if I was interested to come and join them. I said, yeah, why not? So that's how, he introduced me, and I went for a job interview, and I think I got it. But I was initially the head of online, for Mobi Group. And then I think a year later, they realized that it was essential for the country, a country full of news like Afghanistan, to come up with a 24/7 news channel. So Tolo News was established in 2010. And I was involved with it, from the initial days. I was already in the company, leading a significant part of the newsroom, and that's how, I jumped the ladder. 2011, I officially became the head of Tolo News. I was pretty young. If I had the opportunity today, I should have probably rejected it.
Yeah, why?
I think I was probably too young for the job. I had to make sure I put a tie on every day, and so for people to take me serious, uh-huh. Right? This country of traditional warlords and politicians and religious leaders who don't take young people quite seriously, and especially if you don't come from a very prominent background. So I had to really make sure I'm noticed.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more of the Axe Files. And now, back to the show. They came to take you and Tolo News quite seriously very quickly because you guys were aggressively covering the country, including conflicts in the country. And you have a country where there are powerful, as you say, warlords, there are drug dealers, there are all kinds of rough characters. And then, of course, the Taliban relentlessly trying to get back into power. And you, I guess the first years were you know, challenging, but not as dangerous. And then you had this situation in Kunduz in 2015, where the Taliban briefly overtook the town.
Right.
And you guys did a story about the rape of young women, college students in housing there by these insurgents. And suddenly the Taliban that had basically coexisted with you, or at least tolerated you, branded you as essentially enemies, as military targets.
Right.
Tell me about that period, because that was, it seems like that's a real, that was a real shift in the story for you, for the network.
Yes. As we were gaining more experience and becoming more comfortable with the job, the environment was becoming more uncomfortable. I think the list of people who hated free press and journalists who were asking questions was getting longer and longer. So as you said, it was not just the Taliban, drug lords, mafia, just strong men. And at the local level, probably for local journalists at provincial levels, they were even more of a challenge to operate. I think Afghanistan was this. Afghanistan had the freest press in the entire region, while being one of the deadliest country for journalists. So that is such an a weird
paradox.
It's a paradox, and I think that is because the journalists in that country really wanted to make a difference and go after stories. And after 2015, the incident that you referred to, we became we were already part of the Afghan politics, but we became really this. We became a tool for the Taliban and others to use it for political purposes. And we tried to convince them and others that they should treat us as a neutral, independent organization. They shouldn't try to politicize the Afghan media, particularly Tolo News. But I think that was too late. And as a result, we had to engage with them, and then I had to travel. Other colleagues had to travel, talk to them, and before the beginning of the peace process with the U.S. As well as after that, in order to make sure we can safeguard some of those changes.
And these conversations, I mean, they had already branded you as belligerents. Were you worried for your safety when you went to meet with them? Was there menace associated with that?
We were worried and concerned about our lives in Kabul more than we were when we were meeting with them in Doha. And elsewhere. It was becoming more and more difficult, particularly when I was placed under a stricter security regime. That I had to, first they said, I have to use an armored car, and then one bodyguard, two bodyguards, right? So it started, adding, and then change house, from one place to another. Don't go home for an entire month, and then change your house. It came to a point where they were asking me to paint your car. So if you have a white car, so paint it to black. And then next month, change the color again. From that perspective, I think the threat was serious. It was not just the Taliban, but Daesh and others.
Right. But I should point out, it just a year after that incident, you were in your compound, and you had a secure compound where your news operation was housed, and you got word of a bombing of a bus. And tell me about that and what that meant to what you learned that very quickly that meant to you and your organization.
It was a tragic evening, January 20th, 2016, when a Taliban car bomb. Just 100 days after they threatened us and labeled us as a military target, they hit a bus carrying my colleagues back to their homes in western part of the city. And as a result, we lost 7 colleagues, 17 others were wounded.
Let me just stop for a second. This bus was a bus that you, in order to sort of protect their safety, is that why you had a bus that took the colleagues to their homes?
We were providing transportation, given that, you know, Kabul and Afghanistan in general, and Kabul in particular, doesn't have, you know, much of a, you know, established public transport. So we were providing, you know, transportation for our staff. And this bus was taking them back home at 7, I think at around 5 p.m. It was a winter night. It was dark already when the bus was hit. We had to rush to the, I think we started reporting, our crew arrived there before we learned that, you know, this was our bus. So they started reporting about it as just another incident. And then we realized that, you know, it was our colleagues. And then we had to rush to the hospitals to find out, you know, who's dead and who's alive and what can be done about it. Unfortunately, that was just the beginning of targeted killings of journalists.
I know how serious you are about journalism. I mean, and I'm a former journalist, and I can only imagine that you were torn in two directions, ripped apart by the loss of your colleagues and committed to covering the story. You were probably, you know, I mean, that must have been, what an agonizing, difficult night.
We were mourning, but at the same time, we were reporting, which was our main duty. You know, my colleagues who were reporting live from the scene, they had tearful eyes. But we couldn't become sensational or too carried away because that was the story of Afghans every day. But it was very painful because, you know, it was so close to our hearts. Particularly when you go to hospitals, you know, I remember that evening trying to identify bodies and burn bodies, you know, burned and then you have to match them with their IDs and then call their families and more painful to see the wounded. And similar incidents happened, years later, and it became, unfortunately, a routine. So looking into all of that, I'm very happy that there is this at least pause in bloodshed, although the price is very high for that. That, you know, I'm sure we'll talk about it. I think we had to talk to all our colleagues to identify whether shutting down the business and the TV channel was the best option, or to continue that. And most people, an overwhelming majority, over I think 95%, they said, you know, that in order to honor their sacrifices, we should keep up.
I know, as I said, I know what it's like to be in a newsroom. I grew up in one, and my colleagues were my family.
Right.
They were my family. I loved them. I knew all about their lives. I spent more time with them than I spent with my own family. And you also were responsible for them. You know, you were the young leader of this organization. How did you deal with your grief?
I cried when I had a chance. I have hardly spoken about it. I'm very happy that, you know, I get a chance years later now that, you know, I talk to you about it. But it breaks you. It's not easy. It somehow leaves you with scars and with damage that, you know, you take it with you throughout your life.
Yeah, your mom wanted you to quit.
But that's what, you know, every mom, you know, does, right? So...
What about your wife? You know, because you mentioned that you had to stay away from the.
I got married in 2018, so
this
so
was that after that incident. Yeah.
Yes.
But by that time, you were under constant threat.
Right. And then I think I was.
She married you anyway, huh?
Well, yeah, I must thank her for that. I think she realized that, you know, she was subscribing to a difficult life. Back in 2016, 2017, the change in our life was so dramatic. And then I was telling my mom that, who was also pushing me very hard, not just to quit, but also to get married. As the only son in the family, I think she badly wanted to see some grandchildren. And then I was like, you know, I'll get married when Afghanistan becomes peaceful, right? And then she said she couldn't wait, huh? Well, she said no. She said, you know, you're gonna die single. So, you know, the. And then I gave up on that idea of Afghanistan waiting. Becoming 100%, you know, peaceful.
I want to talk about what happened subsequent to that in the peace process that failed. But what do you want people to know about these colleagues that you lost? Ultimately, you lost 11, and they were representative of many others across the country. But you knew these 11 people.
Of course.
What do you want people to know about them?
I want people to know that these beautiful souls and young and vibrant Afghans, they had a dream in the most difficult circumstances in one of the most difficult countries in the world. And they believed in themselves, and then they believed in the future of their country. I think they were working so hard. One of the journalists, Samin Faramarz, who we lost on April 5, 2018, he was done with his shift. So he stayed in the office to cover, another story. And then he went to cover a suicide bombing while a second bomb went off. And Samim and Ramiz were killed instantly on that evening. And that says so much about their commitment to their country. So when we talk about Afghanistan, it's not just about numbers. These are, you know, real stories of people who paid the ultimate sacrifice, and they really worked hard. I think their memories, you know, need to be remembered in Afghanistan and abroad. And I'm very happy you brought up that point.
The value and the importance to any country, certainly any free country, any democratic country, of a free press, of a media that's shining a bright light in dark corners. Often at great personal risk, is something that we should value and protect and appreciate. And the world's become more dangerous for journalists in the last decade. And that should be a red flag for people across the world. And we should honor the memory of your colleagues and every journalist who dies trying to bring the story to people, trying to shine that bright light in the corners of our globe. I want to ask you, you in 2019, you were a part of a civil society group that met with the Taliban in Doha, and you've been sort of, you know, you monitored the whole process. When did you have hope for that process? Did you think it was possible to reach some sort of a working accommodation?
We had no other choice but to give it a try. That I believed being the only solution to bringing lasting peace, ending the conflict and bringing lasting peace. But the process went terribly wrong. That disappointed us.
Why did it go terribly wrong?
I think the Taliban's understanding of their talks with the United States was something else, and the U.S. expectation of the Taliban was probably unrealistic. And in the process of U.S. Taliban trying to come to terms, we lost an administration, a government in Kabul, in Afghanistan, as a collateral damage. I think that process of 2 years or 3 years of U.S. Taliban talks resulted in demoralizing the Afghan forces, resulted in letting people in the country down. But in the same time, we didn't have, I want to be very honest about it, we didn't have the right leader in Afghanistan as well, who ultimately, of course, you know, gave up and fled the country at the hour that we needed leadership from him and sacrifice. He fled the country with a bunch of advisors and friends.
You're talking about Ghani, of course.
Right.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more of the Axe Files. And now, back to the show. At what point did you conclude, or was there a point before August 15th, that the government was going to fall?
I was in Islamabad in June 2021, interviewing Pakistan's foreign minister and attending a Track 2 meeting as well with Pakistani officials. And I realized, because of the Taliban's deep relationship with Pakistan, I realized that the Taliban was strongly determined to take over the country militarily. And when I came back to Kabul, I shared my views with friends and others, whom I thought, you know, they should know that that was probably, in my view, the end of the political process. Taliban were taking districts after another, two or three, up to five a day from 400 districts of Afghanistan. But then I think towards the end of July, it was obvious that this government would not last. The 15th of August, the day and how it happened, I think that was unexpected. A lot of people were expecting formal transition to the Taliban or to a shared Taliban, non-Taliban political setup. I think Ghani's escape did not allow that to happen. Probably the Taliban were also too confident by then that it was not necessary for a political compromise on their end. Now that we know, we've heard from U.S. negotiators after fall of Kabul that the Taliban had agreed to give 40% of power to non-Taliban groups. Well, was it going to be better than what we have today? Yes. But was it really enough? Probably some people argue otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
I think, to your question, I think in the last couple of months, the standing of the Republic was very, very shaky.
Could the story have been different, Latfullah? And talk about the U.S. role. You talked about what the U.S. intervention in Afghanistan in 2001 meant in terms of liberating the country and ushering in this era of relative freedom that had been enjoyed before. But were there things that could have been done that would have stabilized the country, short of a continued major military presence of the U.S. and NATO?
Yes, yes, of course. I think the list of mistakes is very long. The first mistake, in my view, was to ignore the Taliban in 2001 in the Bonn Conference. I think when they laid the foundation of a new Afghanistan, they should have seen the fault lines. And they should have seen, you know, what the Talibs really wanted. Taliban leaders now say that their options were very limited, either go to Guantanamo or Bagram prison, or go to the mountains. So they were not given an opportunity to even come and live in a dignified, life, have a dignified life. Let alone including them in the political process. So that's one. Second, I think the engagement with Pakistan, I mean, you can tell us about your time in office in 2009 and particularly 2008-2009 when the new strategy was being developed in Washington. I think the pressure on Pakistan wasn't there to really change the course, and they always managed to find a way. By Pakistan, I don't mean to generalize Pakistan. Of course, you know, we're talking about the specific groups here within the Pakistani establishment.
You're talking about in terms of harboring terrorists and
right. Right. I mean, Quetta Shura is a Pakistan city, right? Peshawar mm-hmm. Shura is a Pakistan city, right? Miram Shah Shura is a Pakistan town, right? So these were not hideouts of the Taliban. These were, you know, declared, sort of celebrated headquarters of
yeah.
Taliban.
And, the quiet accedants of the Pakistani military establishment and the government.
I think that you can never deny was very systematic and effective to fund and lead the insurgency. Also, you know, at great price in their own country, TTP and the victims of Pakistani people. I think third mistake was probably the U.S. engagement with certain elements and groups within Afghanistan, the investment in individuals rather than institutions. I think individualizing the Afghan policy on the U.S. front was definitely a mistake, both under Karzai as well as under Ghani. And when that individual goes rogue, or drifts the lane, then you can see the consequences.
Yeah.
And the consequences are not as desired as you can expect. And then the last piece of mistake of the past 20 years was the U.S. And the way U.S. Taliban negotiations were conducted. Initially, it was a four-segment, intertwined, interconnected a strategy that the U.S. Taliban deal should be only applicable if the Afghan Taliban deal is there. But we secured the first one, lost the second one. I think it was a winner take all for the Taliban.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of controversy here now, looking back at the events leading up to the exit and the execution of the exit, and some of it has to do with whether an evacuation of U.S. personnel, but also Afghans who've been cooperative and helpful to the U.S. should have begun much earlier than it did. Is that a fair critique?
I think so. I think the withdrawal was chaotic. We were all talking about Saigon moment, and now we have a Kabul moment. People, jumping on the planes and, hanging.
Yeah, those images are indelible.
Right.
People hanging on the skids, and yeah.
Right, and I think that tells us so much about how ill-prepared the withdrawal was for U.S. citizens, for NATO allies, as well as for Afghan partners. I think that criticism is well-founded, and I'm glad that I see that the U.S. administration is engaging with the Taliban about safe passage of those who are at risk, because Afghanistan is not safe for people who think otherwise. Even if it is somewhat safe at the moment, there isn't safety and immunity for for those who work for U.S. and other governments. There is that risk, and we see a lot of extrajudicial killing in Afghanistan right now.
I wanted to ask you about the situation on the ground in Afghanistan, but before I do, talk about you left the country during this period as well. Tell me how you navigated that transition. I mean, there must have been some real concern that if once the Taliban took control, that you would be high on their list of people to reckon with.
Well, I don't know if I told you, I was in Oslo 3 weeks ago for talks with the Taliban. It was the first time that a group of civil society, members of a civil society in their individual capacities, had a chance to sit down with the Taliban in greater detail and discuss a potential roadmap for the future. And because I still believe in talks, I still believe in engagement.
And did you leave? Were you encouraged by that discussion?
I'm happy that at least we had an opportunity to share our strong views and our beliefs. If you tell me I'm super excited that things will change, I'm probably not. But would have been different if I hadn't at least shared my view and not attended the conference.
On the ground, I mean, you're not there, but obviously you're communicating with people. What is the situation on the ground in Afghanistan? You know, there is, we hear a lot, obviously there's economic pressures on Afghanistan. The Taliban are trying to figure out how to run a country again. The predictions of just a massive humanitarian disaster are very, very strong. Tell me what the situation on the ground is.
Well, the Taliban are ruling the country. I'm not sure if they're really governing, you know, the country. There is this end of conflict, David, but it doesn't mean lasting peace. So, how to bridge that end of conflict and a lasting permanent peace is, I think, the question of the hour, and that's where a political process is needed. What you see in Afghanistan right now is, of course, less people are dying, which is good. But in the same time, there is this widespread nationwide, you know, sense of hopelessness. This lack of confidence, you know, everyone wants to leave the country. This humanitarian crisis that you mentioned, two-thirds of Afghans do not have enough food this winter. And 95 to 97% of Afghans are going to be under poverty line next year. 5 million kids are facing acute malnutrition as we speak. But at the same time, you see this peaceful resistance happening by women of Afghanistan, who were not necessarily activists, rights activists under the Republic. They are coming from different professions and backgrounds, and because they don't see a future for themselves, they come to the streets and protest. And that says so much about, you know, some of these restrictions, and of course the restrictions on media. The Taliban's, I think, interference, particularly from their intelligence agency, in the day-to-day affairs of media, it's something unprecedented and painful for somebody like me to see.
You've resigned as the director of Tolo News. You were, for some period after you left the country, you were trying to manage the network from abroad. You're no longer doing that?
Right. I'm not sure if I really worked hard enough after the fall of Kabul, simply because you can't run a newsroom from afar.
Yeah, right.
But I kept the title based on suggestions from colleagues who didn't want more controversy when they had enough on their plates. But at some point, you know, I realized that I haven't said it publicly yet, but at some point, you know, I thought maybe I should just simply put an end to this phase of, you know, my professional life. So I stepped down. And as you said, I think before the beginning of our conversation, that probably 10 years is good enough, you know, of a period. I think mine was just a little bit more than that.
You've talked about the, and you talked about it earlier here, about the impact that the transition had. And, you know, you had, and this is related to the protests you've talked about, but women's rights, young girls going to school, a free press, a interaction with the world that didn't exist before through, I mean, Tolo and the network and Tolo News brought the world to people. The internet brought the world to people. And you've said you can't unring that bell, that once you give people that experience, you can't turn the clock back.
Exactly.
And has that proven out? I mean,
I think the protests in Kabul is something that we didn't have when the Taliban were there first time around. Women of Afghanistan weren't as empowered and educated and informed as they are today. And that says so much about some of the real gains of the past 20 years. That cannot be undone. You know, I agree with you. I think it's, as I said, you know, the Taliban can rule the country. But they won't be able to deliver and govern and have public support unless they really change. It's also difficult to expect them change, but they at least should see other changes around them and commit to an ecosystem where all these realities can coexist.
That's true, certainly in the short run, when you have people who have experienced the last 20 years. Will that be true 5-10 years from now?
20 years is a very long time, and some of the surveys that I had seen before fall of Kabul was putting approval rating of democracy on a republic system, you know, more than 80%. And this comes from rural Afghanistan. This comes from, you know, not necessarily the urban areas. And that says so much about, you know, what kind of vision Afghans have for themselves and what kind of country they want. And I think they have tested it. They have tested freedom. They have tested free press. They have tested international engagement. You know, what they have right now is not what they wished for. Even from a security point of view, there's no guarantee that, you know, the current, structure in Afghanistan is guaranteeing security in Afghanistan, as well as those who are involved, particularly the United States, who does not want another 9/11 to, God forbid, to happen.
And what is your message to Americans?
Well, I think America was part of an Afghanistan story that changed the country for better. I think the Afghan people, or me as an individual here, I'm grateful to the American people for what they have, done, and their support for the Afghan cause. As as an American policy, American administration policy, you know, we can go into greater detail and analyze that and go through a list of mistakes, which we briefly did earlier. But I think to you know, ordinary American public and listeners of our conversation, they should be proud of their engagement with Afghanistan, and they made real difference, and I'm sure Afghans are grateful.
And what now? What should America be thinking and doing now?
I think the good thing that's happening is that if the Taliban are abandoned or semi-abandoned, the people of Afghanistan are not. The U.S. is still the largest donor to the country. $500 million have been paid to Afghanistan for the humanitarian support in the past 6 months. I think that support should continue, because that's when the Afghan people need it the most. We can debate how and when to make sure that the Taliban are not benefited from that support and use it to suppress the Afghan people more. But I think that engagement with the Afghan people should continue, and it shouldn't be after the Cold War when the international community, the U.S., just forgot about everything in Afghanistan, including its people. I see that distinction this time around.
So tell me about your life now. We've been speaking a lot, and you've been a wonderful, splendid fellow at the Institute of Politics at the University of Chicago. You're in Canada right now with your family. But in addition to all of the responsibilities and all of the memories with which you are burdened, you really have been kind of trying to figure out where to live. And tell me what that's been like, and how you and your family are managing.
Well, I want to live in Afghanistan. I still sometimes, you know, I wake up and I miss, you know, going to the office and meeting people and friends. But it's difficult. I think the adjustment is going to take a lot of time. I'm still undecided on so many fronts, whether that's professional, you know, or personal. I'll be involved with things related to the Afghan media, particularly, but in general with Afghanistan. I think if I can contribute to that country in one way or another, I think that's what I owe back to Afghanistan.
Have you tried to go back?
No. I went to Pakistan in November, and I wanted to go in and discuss and sit down with the Taliban in Kabul. But then some friends suggested that I shouldn't do it, because in that particular week that I was in Islamabad, the Taliban had issued a very strong anti-media statement that was not leaving a lot of room for meaningful interactions. I think probably it's not necessarily a safety issue, but it's definitely a productivity and impact issue. Mm-hmm. You know, whether you know, you are free to do whatever you want. I think that's that's probably my biggest concern.
You mentioned earlier that you have two small children, and what do you want for them? You described the way you grew up. What do you want for them? And how much does that weigh on your decision?
I think a lot. I didn't know it, you know, before I had children. I definitely don't want them to go through, you know, the difficulty that I went through. But at the same time, I don't want them to forget Afghanistan or where we come from. What does that mean to me and to their mother and to their, you know, grandparents? I'm hopeful, and I'm an optimist. I hope that, you know, the current situation in the country changed for better. I believe the status quo, the Taliban current way of ruling won't last long. You know, it either goes south or they commit to a political process and improve the situation. And if that changes, you know, I think the best place for us, you know, is the place that we know best.
Latfullah, you are a great inspiration to me. I feel honored to know you. I appreciate the sacrifice of you and your colleagues and your struggle. I'm sure we're going to hear a lot from you in the years to come. Thank you.
Thank you, David. An honor. Thank you for having me. And it's an honor to know you. And thank you for the opportunity that you gave me to be a fellow with the Institute of Politics.
Well, we look forward to seeing you again soon. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Axe Files, brought to you by the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN Audio. The executive producer of the show is Allison Siegel. The show is also produced by Miriam Finder Annenberg, Jeff Fox, and Hannah Grace McDonald. And special thanks to our partners at CNN, including Rafina Ahmad, Courtney Koop, Ashley Lusk, and Megan Marcus. For more programming from the IOP, visit politics.uchicago.edu.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.